Just a quick bulletin for those who normally listen to this podcast. I don't want to get into it, but Stuber Gear, we're just going to leave it at innocent until proven guilty. He should be back on the podcast tomorrow. I think the judge is just going to, you know, let it go. I don't think it was that big of a deal, but we'll find out. Stu will probably be with us tomorrow. In the meantime, Pat Gray is filling in for Stu, and we've got a fantastic podcast for you today. Stuff you're not going to hear anywhere else, including Oppenheimer. We are telling you the story of the bombing, unlike anyone else can. Wait until you hear it. That and so much more on today's podcast, brought to you by Relief Factor. Are you in pain? Why not get out of pain? It can't be that hard. Just think your way out of it. Get over it. Come on, shake it off. Oh, I love all of those things. Stop whining. Okay. Does anybody have another suggestion? Why, I do, friend. It's called Relief Factor, and you can get it for 3 weeks. Just try it for 3 weeks.
Why only try it for 3 weeks?
Well, 70% of the people who try it for 3 weeks go on to order more. Thus, we can...
And think that maybe people don't have money?
No, no, friend. That maybe... It only works for about 70% of the population, so try it. The 3-week quick start, $19.95, relieffactor.com or 1-800-4-RELIEF. 1-800-4-RELIEF, relieffactor.com. Thanks, friend. Here's your podcast.
You're listening to... The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Welcome to the program. It's Glenn and Pat. Stu is, let's just, innocent until proven guilty. We'll leave it at that, tell you more later. It should be, he's unavailable right now, but I think the attorneys will have this all cleared up and he'll be back tomorrow. A Lowe's employee was fired from her job for attempting to stop shoplifters trying to steal over $2,000 worth of merchandise in Georgia. Now, let me say this. I really would like to bring to you with the understanding that there are two kinds of people in America. There are the kind of people that create good things in America and those that enable really bad things to happen in America. Donna Hannesborough previously worked at the Lowe's store in Renton, Georgia. It was four weeks ago. It was in June 25th. The then employee attempted to thwart a shoplifting attempt. Three suspects reportedly loaded up a shopping cart with merchandise and exited the home improvement store with the stolen items. The police department said in a statement, Lowe's employee, Donna Hansborough, attempted to stop one of the subjects by grabbing the shopping cart. She did not at any time make contact with any person. The cart that Donna grabbed was in the possession of a subject, Taika Berry. After Donna grabbed the cart, Berry struck Donna in the face three times, causing Donna's right eye to swell and blacken. The police department identified the other two shoplifting suspects as Jamar Lawton and Joseph Berry, the uncle of Taika Berry. Police say they had arrested Lawton, but are still searching for the uncle and the niece suspects. Authorities say that trio stole merchandise worth $2,100. Police said Lowe's fired Hansborough for attempting to stop the theft, which violated the company's policy against intervening with shoplifters. Hansborough had worked for Lowe's for 13 years. They say if you see somebody stealing something and taking it out the door, not to pursue, not to go out. I lost it. I grabbed the cart. I don't actually remember going out, but I did. And I grabbed the cart that had stolen items in it. I just get tired of seeing things go out the door. I just lost it. Thank you. I want to get her on the air. Sarah, can you ask one of our producers, see if we can get Donna on the air? I would really like to talk to her, because that is who we should be. You can't have these companies that are just saying, yeah, just let them go. If you let them go, it's only going to get worse. Mm-hmm. What one generation tolerates, the next generation embraces. So what does that mean as it gets worse and worse? Do we still happen to have the video from San Francisco from the mall last week? I think it was in Friday's stack of stuff. It's amazing. One of the biggest malls in San Francisco, right down by the harbor, beautiful mall, ghost town, absolute ghost town. This guy took on YouTube, he just took a tour of it and showed empty, 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 not a soul in the place. There was like one, I think it was a nail salon in it. And it's got a Hyatt Regency attached to it. It was a really nice place. Now it's just so dangerous. Nobody can do anything. What do you suppose, Lowe's, your policies lead to? You either have to work for companies that get this, and if your company is this far off the base, they are part of the problem. They will only increase the danger in your neighborhood. If they don't, robbers just feel they can get away with anything and nothing's going to be done, you will be ruled by the worst kind of people, whether they're in office or just ruling your streets. It's insane. And everybody who is doing it, every person that is in a city and it's happening to you, you have to stand up. You have to stand up to your city council. You have to stand up to your mayor or your governor or whoever's launching this garbage.
Ugh. Otherwise, we're going to lose it all. And that's why, how many businesses have moved completely out of San Francisco now? It's been, I mean, this was months ago. It was at least two dozen. And I think it's way more than that.
Oh, it's more than that.
Yeah, I think it's way more than that.
It's like Nordstrom's is gone. The big stores are gone. Yeah. Yeah. Try to get medicine from a CVS, gone.
They can't handle the theft anymore. And that's why you see so many convenience stores or stores in downtown San Francisco locking everything up. There's nothing you can go buy at a convenience store in San Francisco anymore without the employee coming in and locking that area, because people just come in and steal it all.
So bad. I went to a CVS or a Duane Reade when I was in New York last time. I think it was around Christmas last year, and it was insanity. There were employees that had keys for every single row. And if you wanted something, you had to wait for the guy with a key to get into that row. And it was like toothpaste.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
It was like a prison pharmacy. It was crazy.
How much has that hampered their business, too? I mean, the sales have to go down a lot because of that. And nobody wants that.
Well, you're not just grabbing stuff off the shelf. There's anything that you're like, I don't know, I'll give that a try. That's over. Mm-hmm. You go specifically for what you're looking for. Hey, an update for you. On Friday, we brought you the exclusive that Fox News Corporate had a program that matched donations to charities like Planned Parenthood, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the Satanic Temple. They were matching 100% donations to the Satanic Temple and others. My producer, Ricky, saw it with her own eyes via a video tour from a whistleblower inside, spoke with three sources inside of Fox to confirm. We showed you the evidence in the screenshots and then did our due diligence and asked Fox why would they match donation to charities that hate Fox News and go against their audience's values. Would it be a for you if they were using Fox Nation subscriber money to match donations to these charities? We also asked them why Billy Graham's Evangelical Association was not eligible for donation matching. Maybe it had to do with a DEI-like donation policy, or maybe it was just a glitch. We don't know. We started our investigation on their portal. There has been an update now showing that an invitation to Billy Graham charity had been sent to join the Fox Giving program. Now, that's curious because that makes you understand that groups like the Satanic Temple are not auto-loaded, it seems, into the Fox Giving portal by third-party apps if invitations to join the portal are being sent. We can't confirm the little mystery there because they never got back to us. Even though we have, haven't really heard a peep from Fox, our source, noticed a pretty big update over the weekend. On Wednesday night, we pulled a screenshot from the portal where we could see on the screen how the Satanic Temple was eligible for 100% donation, a match from Fox up to $1,000. We showed it to you on Friday's broadcast. You're seeing it now if you're watching The Blaze. By Sunday morning, the Satanic Temple was still in their Fox Giving portal, but you can see it's no longer eligible for donation matching. Oh, so now just the Satanists that want to give, they can give. We'd like to know. We've reached back out to Fox to ask, and we'll keep you updated if we hear anything back or see anything change. This is incredible how far Fox has fallen.
Thus, the dump Fox promo code, perhaps, where you get $30 off your subscription.
Well, I mean, here's one thing we don't do. We don't give money to Planned Parenthood or Verizon
or the Satanic Temple.
The Satanic Temple.
Yeah.
We don't do that.
And so you won't match
funds going to that? I don't give anything to the Southern Poverty.
Huh. That's
no,
weird.
No, I won't do it.
Isn't that discriminatory, Glenn? Isn't that discriminatory? Isn't that a little bit discriminatory?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I have what's called a discriminating taste. You know, it used to be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're like, oh, I don't know. It's my money. I want to put it to the right place. Let me think about it and use some discrimination to say Satan, God. I'm going to go with God. I'm going to go
with
God.
And, okay.
You know. And it's hard because Fox News is so much, much bigger than I am. So they got a lot of money going to that Satanic Temple, which, by the way, I am so done with people saying, oh, they're not really Satanist. What would you expect a Satanist to say? Going to tell you the truth? We don't really. Yeah, we're not really Satanists. We just do that, you know, and we say that and, you know, put Satan statues around, you know. Because it's provocative, you know, it's provocative and, you know, gets people to think, does it? and, you know, sure. We've gone to court, to try to force New Mexico to, you know, give us the go ahead on the, ritualistic abortion ceremony that we do. But that's, you know,
nothing to do with Satan, though, right?
No. Nothing to do with Satan. No.
No.
We're just ritualistically killing a baby. And there's a lot of people that do that, you know, that aren't connected to Satan. Can't think of any right now.
Did you just see the Gallup poll that shows that belief in God is down to 74% in America now? And they did five spiritual entities. They did God, hell, heaven, angels and the devil. 74% believe in God. Only 58% believe in the devil. How is that possible that there's not... If you believe in one, wouldn't you...
Well, he doesn't exist.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No, he does not exist.
Exactly.
Everybody says that the devil exists. They have no idea what they're talking about. Just a guy with a deep voice. Points on his head, but other than that, no, nothing to it.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So let's start with the movie Oppenheimer. And some of the things that will bring it to life. If you happen to be at the museum when we took it on the road here recently, and by the way, I'm having meetings hopefully next month with some companies that will help us take it on the road all next year so it can be seen all over the country. It is truly remarkable. And I want to just show you, this was just one small section of the World War II section, and it revolves around everything that Oppenheimer did. When we dropped the bomb, we had no idea what it was going to do. We have now in the collection, and this was just purchased, so we don't have the physical object with me, and I can't give you the full... I can't read you the whole thing because I don't have it yet. But it was a letter to his mom and dad. He was the co-pilot of Enola Gay. He also was asked to keep a calendar, a TikTok, if you will, minute by minute, what was happening. And I've read the original, and it is unbelievable. But let me give you the summary of it here because I don't have the original. Briefing at 2400, eating at 0030, mom and dad. We started engines at 0227. We taxied out and took off at 0235. We then got off the ground at exactly 245. At the last minute before takeoff, our cruising altitude had been changed, which means possibly a rougher trip. Starting out as an uneventful flight, he then continues to record as the bomb technicians make the final adjustments to the bombs. At 0320, items 1 through 11 were completed by Captain Parsons. In an echo of his hope to fly the mission and his resentment at being relegated to co-pilot, he says Colonel Tibbetts has been hard at work with the usual tasks that belong to the pilot of a B-29. As the hours count down, he begins to write, and now everything is in the dark. There are no lights inside the B-29. They don't want any indication that this plane is up. He begins to write everything in the dark, and you can see sometimes his handwriting is very slanted and goes into other lines. By 0552, it's beginning to be real light outside. Then, climbing to 9,000 feet, we'll stay here until we're about an hour away from the Empire. Then the bomber makes a rendezvous with two other B-29s equipped with observation and photographic gear. Together, the three aircraft climb to an altitude of 30,000 feet. Everyone will be relieved when we have left our bomb and get halfway home. Better yet, all the way home. At 0730, he writes, "We are loaded. The bomb is now alive. It's a disturbing and funny feeling knowing it's right in back of you." Now, at this point, Hiroshima has been identified as the primary target. Two secondary targets had also been selected in the event of unfavorable weather conditions. The two scout planes radio back information on the conditions, cloud conditions, et cetera, over the targets. "We just received a report that our primary is the best target. So we will make a run on Hiroshima. Right now, we're 25 miles from the Empire." Finally, the crews were in place and it was time to execute the mission. quote, "There'll be a short intermission while we bomb our target." This was followed by a brief blow-by-blow description of the bomb run, culminating in the detonation at 8:16:02 a.m. For the next minute, no one knew what to expect. The bombardier and the right seat jockey, or pilot Tibbs, both forgot to put on their dark glasses and therefore witnessed the flash, which was terrific. 15 seconds after the flash, there were two very distinct slaps on the ship. Then there was all the physical effects that we felt. We then turned the ship so we could observe the results. And there, in front of our eyes, was it, without a doubt, the greatest explosion man has ever witnessed. He then, on the paper, draws what he saw. Struggling for words at this minute, he finally continues, "I am certain the entire crew felt this experience was more than any human had ever thought possible. It just seems impossible to comprehend. Just how many did we kill? I honestly have a feeling of groping for words to explain this. Or I might say, my God, what have we done? If I live 100 years, I'll never quite get those few minutes out of my mind." That's from the co-pilot of the Enola Gay, the Little Boy Mission number one. We did it again. But we did something else before we dropped this bomb. Because of Oppenheimer, because they had seen it and they did not ever want it dropped, Harry Truman knew if we drop this bomb, it will mean that we'll probably come to an end of this war, and it will actually save lives. Because the Japanese had been convinced by the emperor that we were savages and that we were worse than their worst nightmare. And remember, they were, I believe, the Japanese in China were worse than the Germans with the Jews. They just slaughtered them in just such brutal, brutal ways. They weren't people, just like the Germans didn't see Jews as people. But because Oppenheimer saw what could be done and all of the scientists involved knew the destructive power, they made Truman a deal. You can only drop this if you warn the people. And so if you're watching Blaze TV, Pat will hold up. How many do you have? One or two?
I have two. First one is the planes dropping bombs on one side. So like a photograph of that. And on the flip side of that are the words that they sent to the Japanese. So in other words, this is coming your way. And then they tell them what to do about it.
Right. They say, you're not our enemies. We're picking these 10 cities, and in the next 10 days, we will drop a bomb of more destructive power than is imaginable. And please leave. You're not our enemy. Take food and water with you. We dropped 70 million on 10 cities before we dropped each bomb. 70 million leaflets. Nobody had ever done that, ever in the history of the world. But nobody in the history of the world had ever seen anything like the atomic bomb. What else do you have there?
It looks like a Japanese family on one side.
And saying the same thing.
Saying the same thing on the other side.
Yeah.
Telling them to get out.
So we
get
have,
out of Dodge.
Yeah. We have several of those leaflets, and that's not something I was ever taught when I was in school. So we drop the bomb, and let me show you the first bomb in Hiroshima. We have, do you have just regular coins? These are just Japanese coins. Mm-hmm. So hold those up to the camera. These are just
normal coins. Yeah. Like three of them.
Just teeny, teeny.
Tiny.
Yeah, they're like pennies or dimes. Yeah.
Smaller even than a penny.
Yeah. So those are the Japanese coins that would have been on somebody's desk or at a bank. But there was a stack of coins. We don't know where, but there was a stack of coins at Hiroshima, all stacked up. When the blast hit, it fused a stack of coins together.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there's 10 of them are here, or 15, something like that, and they're all fused.
And they're
from the heat.
All just fused and, burned. We have the show, the regular marble, Pat. There was a marble at Hiroshima, and that's the regular. It's just like a big Aggie,
mm-hmm.
right? Doesn't have an American flag in it, but just a big Aggie. Now, this is the same marble that was within the blast site, and it has just been exploded from the inside. It's a little bigger inside too, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Pat?
Yeah. It's quite a bit bigger.
And mm-hmm. And it just, the heat just exploded it from the inside. It's crazy looking.
Amazing.
So Hiroshima didn't work. So we had to do it again. Little boy was mission number one. Fat man was number two. And we dropped leaflets. You've never seen the size of Jeffy. He's enormous. He will kill everybody in the area. It was a different fat boy. So fat boy, we dropped over Nagasaki. What most people don't know is the history of Nagasaki. So I think one of the more incredible things we have in our collection, we have the Bombs Away faceplate from the Enola Gay, given to a gentleman from Captain Tibbetts years ago. And he described watching the light right above the Bombs Away. But we also have something from Nagasaki. Nagasaki was the second city to be hit. Most people don't know Christianity was banned in Japan up until about 1900. Nagasaki was the hideout for Christians. It had become the underground Christian area of Japan. And when they made it legal to be Christian, they built a giant Catholic church, a cathedral there. That cathedral was only about 1,000 yards away from Ground Zero. If you look for it online, you should look for it. It is incredible. You look for it online. It is a massive cathedral. They were in prayer and having mass at the time. And it was really pretty much completely vaporized. You can see where one of the towers kind of was, but everything else is just gone. There was a bell in the bell tower. It survived. And it is now in the Remembrance Park in Nagasaki. And I believe they ring that bell every year as a reminder. There was one other bell that survived that same church, and it's a lot smaller. And I'm doing our investigation on it right now, so we're not sure if this is accurate, but we believe this was one of the communion bells. So when communion would be served, it would be rung, the bells would ring. And this is one of the bells. This is the only other bell that survived from that church. Can you read what it says on it?
Angelus Nagasaki.
Yeah, and it's in Japanese on the other side. And it is stained, they think, from the blast. Would you hold it up and ring it, Pat?
Yeah. It doesn't have a ringer, so.
Oh, did you guys take out the ringer? I put the ringer in.
Yeah. No,
JP,
no ringer.
Go get the ringer, would you, and put it back in. I know we don't want to ring it very often, but I think it's
I think it's
appropriate as we're talking about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. You know how to put that in there.
This was, I've tried to get that bell for 15 years.
Still rings, even after having been through an atomic blast. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Mm.
And by the way, the reason why I'm not holding these up or showing them or even in the room is we haven't had any radiation check on it yet. So.
Thank you for that. Yeah, no, that helps.
So I'm
that
sure, helps. Pat,
yeah, I'm
sure
it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we don't actually, we have not done a Geiger counter test. We just all assumed
these fine. Things.
We should, you're fine, of course.
What was it they always
said? Who's got a Geiger counter?
You'd have to vacate the area for 10,000 years before things are not radiated anymore. It's been, what, 70? Right. That's pretty close.
it's pretty close. And we washed it. You're wearing rubber gloves. Yeah. So stand up and look at your chair. Is there an X-ray burned into your chair?
Big outline of my butt cheeks on the chair. Yes. Yeah. Isn't that great?
You know, what's so amazing is those of us who are older and grew up in the era of the Cold War and the bombing and everything else, and my parents and grandparents remembered the bomb. There was a healthy respect for the danger of that kind of weapon. Now it just seems to be like, hey, they might use nuclear weapons. And nobody seems to really talk about the grand effects of using a nuclear weapon. It's a little disturbing. Maybe we should take our kids to Oppenheimer and make sure they understand the ramifications.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Christopher, how are you, sir?
Doing very well. How are you?
I'm so happy for your success and so happy for all of the things you've done. So few people have done as much as you have. So congratulations and thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. America's Cultural Revolution. Tell me what your push is here in the book.
Absolutely. America's Cultural Revolution. It's my new book. It opened as the number one bestseller on Amazon last week. And I think it's doing battle with your new book on the bestseller charts currently. Yeah. But the basic story is this. It traces the 50-year history of the radical left's long march to the institutions, beginning in the Marxist-Leninist revolutionary movements of the late 1960s, going through academia, going through the K-12 school system, weaving its way into the DEI departments and major corporations, and finally coming to full fruition in that turbulent summer of George Floyd in 2020, when I think many Americans finally understood that the left had really seized all of those cultural institutions that matter. I explain exactly where it comes from, exactly how the ideology works, and most importantly, exactly how it's attained power so that conservatives can start understanding how to formulate a solution.
So can you give me those 3 points in the time that we have, kind of summarize?
Yeah, absolutely. And the book is divided into the theory of revolution, the theory of race and how that is used to gain power. Education, so pedagogy, meaning how kids are taught. And so this is something that the left has thought very deeply about. They have thousands of activists fanned out across the country trying to figure out how to make your kids think in the same ways that they do. And then finally, the last section of the book is about power. So a lot of conservatives feel that we can simply win the intellectual debate, that politics is an Oxford debating society. And if you have the better points, you have the better arguments, you have the better facts, you win. But I show that that's actually not always true. I wish it were true. But in the real world, the left attains power in many cases, no matter how bad their ideas are. So I outline exactly what they do, how their political practice works. And I think that this is really new territory for a lot of conservatives, even very literate conservatives who love to read about the history of ideas. This is about how ideas gain power. And that's what I try to do in the book.
So what is it, the main thing that you think conservatives don't understand about defeating this or dealing with this power?
I think the main thing conservatives don't understand is that institutional power requires the governance of institutions, and institutions are not governed by the laws in the books, the policies in the training manual. Although those are important, you actually have to have your people staffing those institutions. And so if you look at K-12 schools, for example, the radical left, I mean, really, truly, the neo-Marxist left controls all of the graduate schools of education that train our K-12 mm-hmm. teachers. They're teaching Paulo Freire's Marxist theory. They're teaching critical race theory. And conservatives, if they wanted to have an influence to the same degree on K-12 education, would actually have to get conservative graduate school students, conservative professors, conservative administrators. And it seems that conservatives have been content to occupy themselves with their own family, their own churches, their own businesses, perhaps. But they've ceded the active governance of cultural institutions to people who hate them. And all of a sudden, they're waking up and thinking, wait a minute, we have to either recapture these institutions or we have to build alternatives. And my argument at the end of the book is, of course, we have to do some of both.
So, Christopher, you know, when we were hit by Al-Qaeda, the country was asking, what do they hate us? Why do they hate us so much? And people say, well, because of our freedom. I didn't think that was it. I think it's because we engaged in some really dark stuff all around the world, and we are not who we say we are many times, especially in the Middle East. But why do these people hate us so much?
I think that in the immediate term, they view the average conservative family or conservative citizen as an impediment to their utopia. And so what I found so fascinating in the book is that all of these revolutionary figures from the 60s who've really laid out the groundwork for what we see today were genuine believers in the utopia. They had an idealistic temperament in most cases, but in all cases, it grew sour. They grew disillusioned. They grew angry. They grew resentful. And so you can see this emotional arc. And I think that's where really the modern left begins. It's a group of people who oftentimes are very smart. They're very idealistic, but they're very frustrated at what they see around them. And it turns into a kind of resentment towards people who are viewed as either successful, but also people who are viewed simply as average, middle class, content with their lives, occupied with their local communities. These are barriers to their revolution. And so they want to first and foremost change the system of government to take power over them, but also even take power over their kids by changing how kids learn and really fomenting revolt of the child against the parent. And that's what we see as the key symbol throughout this revolution. I mean, this is truly a revolt of children against their parents, symbolically, archetypally, and then also in many cases, quite literally.
If you were sitting in a map room and you came in and we were losing the war and I'm Churchill and I said, Christopher, what do we do? What would be your plan of attack? What do we need to do? And what are the odds that it works at this point?
I think that there are really a few key strategies that I would recommend. First, I would recommend reforming American civil rights law, which is often used to force these left-wing ideologies well beyond the bounds of colorblind equality. And so I would go in, I would have executive orders lined up, legislation, trying to get some cases before the Supreme Court to restrain the civil rights bureaucracy so that it can't force, you know, diversity trainings and CRT trainings, but actually just ensures that Americans are treated equally. Second, I would get, as we've done now in 7 states, universal school choice so that parents can take their taxpayer dollars out of the public school system and into any other school of their choice. That's going to shift billions of dollars in resources towards creating alternative schools, religious schools, private schools, other kinds of schools, homeschools, where conservatives can start to have institutions that reflect their values, they can invest. And then third, I think we need strong action from state legislatures. Governor DeSantis has started this in Florida, of retaking some of the administration in public universities. And I have a personal goal, Glenn, of reforming state higher education policy to recruit 1,000 conservative professors in the next 10 years. And I think even a thousand academics that are aligned with us, that create materials and research and scholarship, that's going to be enough of a counterbalance at the beginning to reshape the dynamics within academia.
How are you going to get that through? I mean, especially, I mean, just talk about school choice, universal school choice. Even in Texas, they refuse that because the Republicans in many states that are wildly red, they are still beholden to the teachers unions. And those teachers unions are so powerful.
Well, there's a way to do it. And I think Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, who actually had the first universal school choice bill passed through his state legislature, the first one in the country, you know, he told me something quite interesting. He said, hey, we had the same problem in Arizona. Rural Republicans were hesitant to do this. They didn't want their Friday Night Lights football impacted. So he made a deal where he essentially horse traded. He said, hey, look, we'll increase public school funding by $1 billion. You're going to get a ton of money from the legislature to invest in your public schools, your athletic programs. But in exchange, we want to give everyone a way out. And now $1 billion a year approximately has been taken by parents and then invested into school alternatives. This is within just two years of this program. And so you have to go and do the old school backroom, cigars in the back room, horse trading. And sometimes you have to write a big check to get those few Republicans that are beholden to the teachers union, overwhelm them, sweeten the deal, do whatever it takes, because long term, this is more important than any short term budgetary outlay.
So our institutions have been so overtaken by the ESG culprits that Budweiser doesn't seem to care at all that it's just destroyed itself. Disney doesn't seem to care that it's destroyed itself. And I think Disney is they're not really being forced from the outside. They're gone from the soul. But all of these ESG companies now, is there a way to turn that around?
I think there is. I think if you look at ESG, you have to think of it as a kind of parallel civil rights bureaucracy that is organized by cartels kind of corporate cartels, right? And so just like with the civil rights law in the United States, which needs significant reforms, and the answer is quite simple. It's you have to get the people through their elected legislators creating general laws that govern the republic. And so we need a revival in the legislative capacity and creativity and commitment. And you can simply say, in the United States, the law is that corporations that are chartered by the state, you know, companies are chartered, they have to be prioritize return on investment. The goal of a capitalist economy is to maximize profits. And then these specific facets of ESG style investing are political ideology, political activism, and it is restricted for publicly traded companies. If you want to have a small business and you want to have a communist bake shop and not charge anyone any money, that's fine. But if you are a multinational company, you have pension funds investing in you, you're listed on the stock exchange, I think legislators are well within their right to shut down policies, really kind of cartel-like policies like ESG.
Yes. Christopher, what was the biggest thing since you started this whole thing? What is the most shocking thing you found? Something you just still today, you're like, I can't believe this.
Yeah, I'll tell you something from the process of writing this book that still shocks me is I spent a lot of time digging into the archives and reading the revolutionary pamphlets and manifestos from the late 1960s. from the Black Panther Party, the Communist Party USA, the Black Liberation Army, the Weather Underground. And these are documents that really haven't been read in many, many years. And what I found that was so shocking was that all of the concepts, all of the phrases, even many of the arguments that I've been seeing the last couple years in K through 12 school curricula in the kind of critical race theory world resemble to a T the ideas, the concepts, even the exact phrases that I found in those revolutionary manifestos. And so you have this immensely shocking translation
trail
from the fringes fringes. These were people who wanted to overthrow the government by force.
Correct.
And now their ideas are in your child's kindergarten classroom. I mean, that to me is just a shocking demonstration of their own triumph.
I have many of the old professors from Chicago, their libraries after they died. A friend of mine would go in and gather the libraries and sell some of the books and all of the radical stuff, including handwritten notes and papers inside of these books. I probably have the largest library now of these kinds of radicals from the 60s and 70s. You're more than welcome to peruse through it if it would ever help you, Christopher.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I'd love to do it because, look, as you know, and as a collector of this, you have to understand what we're dealing with today. You have to understand where it comes from. I mean, if you don't understand where it comes from, you're operating blind. And so the goal of the book is to do that, is to show conservatives, from conservative parents all the way to conservative policymakers, this is what you're up against. This is how they operate, and this is how to defeat them.
Christopher, I'd love to have you on again, maybe even a podcast, just to talk about your book, because we have so much to discuss, and you have a lot to teach. Christopher Ruffo, the name of the book is America's Cultural Revolution. America's Cultural Revolution. It is available wherever you get your books now. Christopher Ruffo, thank you.
One of the best measures of how corrupt a country is how rich its leaders get while they're in office. They're not so good at passing laws or governing, but they're great at investing.
Imagine if every American could make money off of war.
In 103 days, that position ends up gaining around 103%. So she made, $2 million plus her original two, so $4
million. I signed, co-sponsored a bill and made too much voluminous flair over it that I wouldn't be seated. So I shut up. The threats that fly around are just absolutely insane.
The Blaze Originals team traveled to Washington, D.C., home to one of the most brilliant financial minds in the world, Nancy Pelosi. In our documentary, Bought and Paid For, How Politicians Get Filthy Rich, we spoke to Reps Matt Gaetz and Chip Roy, George Santos, and the bane of D.C. elites, Unusual Whales, to expose how our elected officials are beating the stock market and, more importantly, what we can do. To watch today, go to congressgetsrich.com and use code RICH to get $30 off an annual subscription to Blaze TV.